Access number 12502, Reel 3.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, Reel 3. You were telling me about the characteristics of the 12th SAS.
Yes. Well, as I say, they were extremely fanatical. They did fight extremely well. They did stay behind and act as snipers. They very often had to be shot out of wherever they were in hides, and they didn't surrender very easily, but obviously one took a certain number of prisoners. And they were very tough nuts to crack, although at Epsom, of course, some of the people who did the damage were engineers who were holding a sort of outpost line across the front. But you see, the Bocage country certainly couldn't really be considered to be good tank country. It could be considered to be very good anti-tank country, because you didn't get long peals of fire, you couldn't move your tanks very fast, or your half-tracks. You had these great sort of sunken ditches and roads, and of course as you came, crashed your way through and went up to the next, you tended to offer the most marvellous target to some anti-tank position in the next bit of cover further on. And so it was a grind, really, tanks moving, infantry having to move through the thick stuff, clearing people away ahead of the tank. And it was a slow, grinding business, there's no doubt about it. And of course it wasn't till much later, till you got onto the sort of fillets, that you got the open, rolling country. People think of Normandy as well, but there is this Bocage, rather like bits of Devon and bits of Cornwall, of course.
I was going to ask you about that, because it's been said that nothing in the preliminary training for D-Day and Normandy had prepared anyone for fighting through that sort of country. Had you ever done any training?
Well, I think there must be an element of this, and nothing really. Street fighting, these things are so difficult to arrange in your own country. Street fighting, when I was a young officer, we did go to the bombed out areas of Leeds and did a bit of that. But you see, most of the training took place on Salisbury Plain or Stamford training area. Stamford's perhaps a bit more Bocage than Salisbury Plain, but I think this is true. I think that people were thinking of the wide open spaces and didn't realise that bits of Normandy were exactly like the lanes of Devon or Somerset or somewhere like that.
When you were in southern England with 4th Armoured Brigade before going to Normandy, what sort of training and exercises did you do?
Hardly any, because there wasn't time. There wasn't time between getting people back from the Mediterranean and them having some leave and coming back and join. And I say, when I joined them, we had but a month. We had the month of May, and we concentrated on low-level stuff. But I don't remember doing a brigade exercise. Now, the new troops, 8th Corps, the 11th Armoured Division, the Guards Armoured Division, and 3rd Division, they had been training for years up in Yorkshire, and they had done some very energetic exercises. But the 4th Armoured Brigade were relying on their battle experience. And, of course, you could say that the country around the Sangrone, places like that, that was pretty close country.
They had done that sort of thing before.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Once Epsom had closed down, with the German counterattacks dying away, What did 4th Armoured Brigade do next?
Well, then it came into supporting the 43rd Wessex Division. They'd come off 112, but they were then going to make a slightly closer circumvention of Caen down to places like Molto, Etteville, and instead of going there, they were coming on this sort of line. I mean, the idea, having got across the Odon, was to get across the Orne, because what Monty wanted to do was to get onto this high ground between Caen and Valais. And that's where he wanted to get his armoured divisions to crack about, as he said. And so it was a continual series of thrusts. Now, Epsom was a big battle. Goodwood was a big battle. This 43rd Division battle, which was written about quite a lot in a book called From the City, From the Plough, never really got off the start line.
This was Operation Green Line.
That's what it was called, was it? I didn't know what it was called, and I no name in it, but we were there to support them and also to exploit, I suppose, any success they had over the Orne. So we were put under command of 43rd Division, who had a pretty difficult time and really didn't get very much further than their start line and had a considerable amount of casualties, particularly in some battalions. I can't remember which one, the DCLI, I think, perhaps, I don't know. And it was there that I got wounded.
How did that happen?
Well, I'll tell you exactly how it happened. We were on the sort of reverse slope just behind the forward battalions, and there was a lot of shelling, and particularly some 88s must have been on a high ground out to our flank, because suddenly we came under the most intense direct fire, 88 fire, which you just hear bang, crash, and the thing was on you. And we were dispersed on this first slope, and the company commander had called an O group. So all the platoon commanders, except one who was away on some sort of patrol, that was the scout platoon commander, were assembled at the half track of the company commander. Company commander, sergeant major, three platoon commanders, signalers and various things. And suddenly there was the most tremendous barrage of 88s arriving all round us. So there was no cover at all. It was a sort of bare cornfield, on the sort of reverse slope, but this obviously, these guns must have been firing from the flank. So we dived underneath this thing, got what cover we could, and shells landed all around, and I was lying next door to another platoon commander, a very nice little man. He was a little man. He was only about 4'7", I remember. We were lying side by side, and more or less in a sort of fairly matter-of-fact way, one of us said to the other, "Do you think we've had it?" So before the other could answer in any particular way, the most almighty crash. And the shell came right through the vehicle and burst underneath. Company commander was killed, sergeant major was killed. And when I looked down at my companion, he was dead. And he was not only dead, but he was the colour of this, absolutely black. And obviously the shell had landed just on the other side of him, and he'd taken the whole force of the blast, and this was black and that. So I was about the only one left at that particular O group alive. I think there was one signaller. And so we got up when there was a slight thing in the shelling, went on very considerably. And I said to the signal, "Look, somehow we've got to move the company across to the next field so that we can get out of this line of this obvious visual sight." And I got up, and I felt the most sort of tremendous burning sensation down my side. And the first thing that passed through my mind was, because so many things were on fire, motorcycles on fire, vehicles on fire, I thought to myself, "Oh, I must have, you know, I must be on fire." So rather stupidly, I threw myself on the ground and rubbed myself, thinking that I was putting the fire. And then I realised it wasn't, and I'd been hit down the side. So at that moment, the scout platoon commander, who'd been away, came across. And so I ran across to him and said, "Look, I think, you know, this is no place to be, otherwise it would be knocked off one, I don't know. Over there, there's a sort of gully which we're out of direct sight, so we must gather the company together." So we rushed around, dodging the shells, and got everybody into their vehicles and picked up the wounded and so on, and we moved across the side of the thing until we'd got into some sort of dead ground. We were still in a position to do what we might have to do in front, but we'd moved across. And by that time, it was fairly late in the afternoon. And when we got in, of course, it was quite clear that I had a large gash in my thigh and bits up the side. So when everybody was settled in, the whole thing had re-established, I went back to the RAP, and they promptly evacuated me. And I went back to a base hospital, and people jabbed one all around. I found myself on a hospital ship, and eventually on a train, and I ended up in Edinburgh, where I had an operation. But it wasn't that bad. And after about, that was date 16th of July, I think, wasn't it? I think it was.
Green Line started on the 16th.
What?
Green Line started on the 16th.
Well, it was the 16th or 17th, which coincidentally was the day we got married 5 years later, our wedding day. But I think that was the day I was wounded. And so when I was discharged from hospital, I went back into the reinforcement train, and they then said, you know, you've been fighting, you must take your turn. Well, anyhow, I thought, you know, I really ought to get back to my platoon. And Field Marshal Gibbs, who was commanding C Company, he'd been wounded on the same day. So he'd been back, he was back in hospital too. And we met up in this reinforcement camp, got ourselves across to Normandy, commandeered a vehicle, because the commandant of the reinforcement camp said, you know, you must. There's a strict rotation for all this. And he said, well, our battalion wants us back. And we got back to the battalion just about when they had closed the Falaise Gap and the fighting stopped in Falaise.
I'd like to ask.
And then we were with the battalion for the rest of the war.
A bit more about this action, Green Line. When you came under this shell fire, do you remember we were on Hill 113 on the reverse slope of that?
Well, we had a place called Fontaine-les-Topiffons. Which is where, here.
And it's somewhere on this side.
The attack was supposed to go in on Malto, I think, or Etaville, and we were just in front of Fontaine-les-Topiffons. We were about, you see you see where the high ground rises to here?
That's that saddle between 112 and 113.
Yes, where's 113? That's 112, isn't it?
That's the Croix des Filandriers, that's 112. 113 is in this direction.
Oh, no. Oh, that's 114. Yeah. No, we were this way. We were here. We were just the village of Fontaine, because I've actually been back to the place, so I know. And I've seen the exact spot. The village of Fontaine-les-Topiffons was just below us, behind us and below us. But we were there.
So you're being shot at from the direction of Calm, presumably?
Well, it must have been, from over here, you see.
And were you sitting there, mounted up in your vehicle,
yes,
ready to go forward.
But nothing was, you know, this thing had got stuck. And at one moment, of course, there was a bit of a disaster here, with troops coming back and so on.
And
our role was to go forward with the tanks and exploit if this got to a certain objective.
But they didn't. They didn't manage to clear the way through for the
They didn't. I don't know which brigade it was, but it was 43rd Wessex Division. It must be pretty well chronicled.
I think the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry were on Hill 112. Certainly, they managed to get up onto the top of it, but they had a very difficult fight to establish themselves.
But that, you say, is further this way.
That's 112 there.
Oh, onto there, yes.
Yes.
Well, this was the area of the battle. Yes. I mean, we were just waiting to go forward. I mean, there was a terrific racket going on altogether. Yes. And we were waiting when they had, I suppose, captured Malta. Mm. And whether they did capture Malta in that battle or not, I'm not too certain. But the thing stopped short of the Orne, I know that.
When you got back to the battalion, you say they just closed the Falaise Gap.
Mm-hmm.
What was the circumstances of the battalion like when you rejoined them?
Well, the battalion. I don't think this goes down as far as the Falaise, does it?
Not quite, no.
This is more chronicled in the chronicle, I think. Well, this is the Falaise Road, isn't it? They were in.
That's the Forêt des Anglais there. I think
no, but there's a very. Curie-Arcourt. Well, they were. Could we stop? I could get it. Now, they had come down. Clissy is where I was here. Clissy. They were with 4th Armoured Brigade. I mean, if you remember, the Falaise Gap was closed somewhere. This sort of on the Trun line. Yeah. Like that. And then there was a great sort of. Like that. Was there anything?
A circling movement.
Yeah. 4th Armoured Brigade were the part which was closing it just west of Falaise and coming down and cutting the road, Falaise Road, just sort of south, somewhere like Cordy or somewhere like that. And they were doing it by attacking into village and then the next village, tank and infantry, using, a proper...
Standard all-arms tactics.
Absolutely. And where exactly they were when I rejoined them, I don't know. But I joined them before we actually went out of the Falaise pocket, because I remember all the absolute carnage of men, vehicles, animals and things like that. And then we headed, of course, towards the Seine.
That must have been a sudden and dramatic change of circumstances, having been pushing through the Bocage against determined enemy resistance in difficult ground, suddenly to be racing in a pursuit.
Well, after getting out of Falaise, yeah, because this bit was still Bocage, of course, in the actual round of Falaise thing. Well, then, of course, the real rush started after crossing the Seine. And remember, Horrocks said to General Pip Roberts, "Pip, it's moonlight. I want Amiens by tomorrow morning." And, of course, that's when they really started driving through everything. 11th Armoured Division, we were on the left, and everything was going helter-skelter, and we just drove through positions. Germans were in the roadside, and we went straight through at a terrific lick. And, of course, Amiens, they captured a core headquarters of the Germans, and we went roaring up towards Antwerp. The right was the Guards to Brussels, the centre was the 11th Armoured Division to Antwerp, and the west was us and the 53rd Division, Welsh Division this time, on the left flank, places like Bever and Vers and St Nicholas and Bruges and things like that. Those were the three prongs that went up. And, of course, then we got into quite heavy fighting because, of course, the Germans in the Pas-de-Calais were starting to come back. And we were in the way, on the left.
Did you actually go through Falaise town and through the gap itself, or did you go around?
We went through what had been the gap, Trun and places like that. We didn't go through Falaise town, no.
And they were absolutely choked with German wreckage and...
The gap was.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. The neck of the gap was absolute carnage. Every sort of thing, because they'd been caught. A few of them had got out, but they'd been caught by typhoons, shell fire from the south and the north. The Poles had fought a terrific action right on the junction. And it was absolute, it was amazing that they ever got going again, of course. And in fact, they didn't really get going again until, of course...
Northern Belgium.
Arnhem.
When you were in Normandy, to look at another aspect, did you have any contact at all with the local French population?
Oh, yes, not always, not always very friendly. I wouldn't like to put... there have been different experiences. The airborne troops were warmly greeted in Ranville, in the chateau, and they go back. But the parts that I found of Normandy farmers were pretty surly. They'd had a reasonably good time under the Germans because they were a food-producing area, and provided they kept their nose clean. Nobody was interfering with them too much. And all they were getting was death and destruction. I remember the first time I was preparing a platoon position somewhere around the places that we were talking about earlier on, and I saw in the farmyards corrugated iron sheets, and this was the middle of the battle. I mean, we weren't on training or anything like that, and I was told to put them in their trenches and put earth on the top, and the French farmers came out and I found none of us could feel very much sympathy with him really at the time. So I felt sorry for them in the sense, you know, how they were swept up and almost appalling back. But there wasn't any sort of great Bayeux, I think, welcomed the Allied forces. And in the odd chateau, which had been undamaged, the ordinary farmer was pretty fed up with the battle that was raging all over his land. I mean, we saw much more of the Dutch and the Belgians later on.
Did you ever take up positions inside buildings while fighting through Normandy?
Now, the first time we did this was... Not in Normandy. Normandy, we were always out in the open, it was very, very open, unspoiled countryside in those days. I mean, if you go to Normandy now and see the built-up conurbation of Caen, you can get no idea of the pastoral nature of Normandy in those days. And there seemed to be no particular cause to be inside a building at all, so we were always outside. But later on, of course, in Holland and places, we did get into buildings in towns and villages, of course, and we defended there. And had some interesting experiences in that.
The Germans seem to have made very good use of the farmhouses and villages for defensive purposes. In Schur, for example, they seem to have had the whole village wired.
Yes, and of course
and
in the villages along the Borchers Ridge. Mm. Yes, and the 11th Army Division had to fight through those villages. That's perfectly true.
So they were strongly built, weren't they? Good stone blocks. The buildings, the houses were built of good stone blocks.
Yes. We could have easily been in places, but I mean, I remember this first platoon position was in the chateau, but we didn't actually go into the chateau. We actually had our platoon positions around the outside of the wall of the chateau. We thought it was less conspicuous and less obvious target. And we thought that we'd be able to do as well from there.
So you were you living under canvas or just lying out in the open?
Oh, lying out in the open. No, we were lying out in the open most of the time. And, of course, we got all sorts of weather. We're talking about Normandy now.
Yes, still Normandy.
Yes, because we had this quite heavy rain, of course, at the time of the storm. One of the things I remember most, of course, was the incredibly short nights to sleep in, because we were in midsummer, absolute midsummer, so it didn't really get dark till after 10, and it started getting light at 3 in the morning, so you didn't have very much for night.
I was going to ask you about how much sleep you...
Well, we tried to sleep in the day, of course, because our job in Normandy had been mostly protecting tanks, and it wasn't until the Falaise time that we started actually to sort of move forward village by village. Because the whole army was moving forward by that time at a an enemy who was not attacking you, but was desperately trying to get out.
So were you able to get enough sleep in Normandy on the whole?
To do what?
Were you able to get enough sleep to...
Oh, I think one always felt very tired for this reason. Because you did try and get it in the middle of the day, but something was happening, you were going to have to plan something, do your administration, you were being called to orders, or you had to mount on a patrol or something like that. So it wasn't all that time. You managed to do on very little sleep.
Did you ever manage to establish anything like a daily routine? Or was every day absolutely different?
Yes, I mean, I suppose you did try the sort of middle of the day to try and get some sleep. I mean, you obviously stood to at last light, and you stood to at first light. And then you had to do your administration, but by about sort of 2 in the afternoon, you probably tried to get some sleep there. If nothing was happening, but you might be moving your location or doing anything like that.
Were you well fed?
Yes. I thought it was. It was compo. Some boxes of compo were better than other boxes of compo, but I don't think one could complain.
How was the feeding arranged in the battalion? Was there a battalion officer's mess, or did you feed by companies or by platoons?
There was no... there was certainly no... Not at that stage of the battle. Later on, when the line became a bit more static, battalion headquarters would have it, but we had no officers' mess as such. I mean, you fed with your platoon. You never went into company headquarters. You fed on your not only with your platoon, on your vehicle. And you might have one chap who more or less did the job of sort of batman for you, but I mean, that wasn't really very much. But he probably saw while you were working things out that you got a slice of the compo and tin of tea, a cup of tea and things like that.
Did the vehicle then evolve into a sort of basic social group that did things together
absolutely,
all the time?
Yeah.
And how many men would there be travelling in a particular vehicle?
Well, the sections were pretty small. We're talking about 6 or 7. That sort of thing. You had the driver, you had your salt, you had your mortar crew. I mean, you didn't have very sophisticated weapons. You had your mortar crew, you had your signaller. So that was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You had a runner, who might be your batman. You had a dispatch rider. But you're talking about 7 or 8 people.
That's your platoon headquarters?
That was platoon headquarters. The section was about the same size.
And so in a platoon, would you have then 4 vehicles? One for the platoon commander and one for each section?
That's right.
And the rifle sections presumably would have the Bren gun and the riflemen.
Yes, they had 2 groups, rifle group, Bren group, but they was 2 small sections, but they were about 7 or 8 men. You see, had the driver who stayed with his vehicle, the commander, and 6, at the most 7 chaps in the back.
Was there armament on the vehicle? Did it have a machine gun?
We acquired things that we put on the vehicles, and we had a big 0.5, at least on some of them, a big 0.5 machine gun that we managed to get to put on the turret of a half track.
How did you manage?
I don't think it was standard issue, but we somehow acquired it.
You don't remember how you acquired it?
No, I don't know. I don't know how we acquired it, but we certainly did acquire things to put on. It may have been equipment of the international half track. I don't know, 0.5 machine gun. But I remember using it to strafe off a barn or something like that.
So really, your section, if it did have a 0.5 and a Bren gun, would have quite a lot of automatic firepower in it.
Well, that's if you had the vehicle with you at that particular time. Because if you were out on your feet, you might or might not be able to use the 0.5. You'd also use it, of course, hopefully, to shoot at any enemy aircraft that came and attacked you, but that wasn't like... There weren't too many of that. We had an enemy air raid on the beaches at the evening we arrived, but the enemy air was pretty scarce.
Was it regarded as a principle that you should dismount to mount attacks?
Absolutely. The vehicle was not capable. Later in the battle towards the Rhine and over the Rhine, of course, we were tied up with these kangaroos, which were tanks with turrets off it, and we were put into those to keep up with the the tanks.
And you could do an overrun in that, an overrun attack.
Yeah, yes.
Driving.
Yes, you
and
could.
Then
and we used these in the Reichsfront. But in Normandy, I mean, the international half track had nothing really. It couldn't stand up to. I mean, turn up to a bit of shrapnel, and maybe small arms from a very long range. But it was a tin can. Of course.
Wasn't properly armoured.
No.
What was its mobility like? Did it have a good cross-country?
Yeah, it's not too bad. It had rubber tracks, which were fairly good. It couldn't go everywhere tanks went. But it wasn't too bad because it was a half track and it had wheels in front. And the drivers managed, four-wheel drive, of course. The drivers managed to get them. But when we were moving across that time I told you after the big 88mm, practically everything had fallen off my vehicle. The door had come off and it was an absolute, things were hanging on to it.
Was it a reliable vehicle? Did you have any problems with maintenance?
No, I think it was very good, and of course it was still in service decades later. Yeah, it was reliable. It was a good bit of pit, and tremendously proud when you first got